On this episode, we are talking about one of the biggest releases of the year, Bioshock Infinite. Is it Game of the Year material, or does its city in the sky fall short of expectations? Find out coming up on This Rant. Everyone, and welcome to this episode of Rambling About Notable Topics. I'm your host, Kyle Cicilline, and today I'm joined by...
Mark Dillman.
Hello, Mr. Dillman. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good, Kai. How are you?
Pretty good. Today we're going to be talking about something that everyone has been talking about lately, and frankly, probably most people are probably sick of hearing about it, but today we're going to talk about Bioshock Infinite, which is one of the biggest releases so far this year. It's getting rave reviews, doing well, and everyone seems to love it. It's out for multi-platform, and so we're here to talk about that and our experiences with it and compare it to maybe the other Bioshock or any other games of similar nature. So, Mark, would you kindly share with us your experiences with Bioshock Infinite?
Sure thing. Well, I guess to start off, we'll probably give an umbrella disclaimer that there will be spoilers in this podcast.
Yes. Spoilers for Bioshock Infinite and for Bioshock, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. So I would say that if you plan on really fully experiencing either of these two games, I guess we'll say three, although Bioshock 2 essentially falls under the header of Bioshock. If you're planning on experiencing those games fully, you should probably tune out right now, but otherwise stay on the horn because we'll hopefully be getting at some real meat and potatoes topics here with Bioshock.
Definitely.
Anyway, I love the game. I mean, I will have to say that it's probably one of the most rewarding player experiences that I've ever had. And I think some of the highlights for me were obviously just the immersiveness of this game. I mean, I think that people are starting to realize that video games are one of the best ways of getting you immersed in a fully thought out world with its own politics, its own aesthetic. And Bioshock has always done that excellently. Another thing I really liked about it, and I think in this way it's comparable to a lot of other games like Ico on the PlayStation 2. I think that it's great because you really get the sense that even though you have a computer companion, that there's a real developing relationship between these two people, that being Elizabeth and Booker. And
right.
I just love that aspect of the game. So what did you think, Sir Cicilline?
Yeah, it's really cool. I was looking forward to this for a long time. And I played the first Bioshock when that came out back in 2007. But I haven't played it since. And I've been really wanting to, and I never played Bioshock 2 at all. Like, I never played it, because I didn't have a 360 until, like, a year ago. So I played it on my friend's console, so I played through it rather quickly. But I never even touched Bioshock 2. But from what I hear, it's not really even worth it. Ken Levine wasn't even on the production on that game, I believe.
Right.
If I'm correct. But, yeah, Ken Levine's the guy, like, the mind behind System Shock 2 and Bioshock and Bioshock Infinite, which I'm pretty sure he started working on, I think I read, in 2008, like right after Bioshock, the first one came out, he started working on Bioshock Infinite. So he's been working on it for, well, it's like 5 years or something now. And this game got delayed quite a bit, and I think it was first shown at E3 one of the game shows, in, I think, 2010 or maybe 2009. Probably 2010. But anyway.
Right. Yeah, I think the first gameplay trailer was E3 2010.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of speculation and looking forward, anticipation for this game. So, and it finally came out, and I played the hell out of it. I beat it in like 3 days or 2 days or something. I flew through it. Like, I played 14 hours or so of it, so I was relatively thorough with going through the game. I didn't pick up all the voxophones or anything. I definitely missed some stuff, but I'm definitely planning on going through again. But what I did was, after I played Bioshock Infinite, I went back and played Bioshock, the first one. And so that was the first time I played that in a long time, and I really wanted to kind of compare it. And I'll get to that in a little bit. But yeah, I really, really loved Bioshock Infinite. I think it's the story that really pulls me in. It doesn't really do much different in terms of, FPS. It doesn't really do much different in terms of that. It's very, kind of run-of-the-mill, not run-of-the-mill shooter. It doesn't really try anything different as far as shooting is concerned. It has the same basic principles as Bioshock. You have, instead of plasmids, you have these vigors that give you supernatural abilities. And then you have, you know, your standard guns. And then, you know, it's just shooting enemies or using vigors in combination to defeat your enemies. So, and then you can level certain things up for your plasmids or your weapons, stuff like that. But yeah, in terms of story, that's really where this game shines. I know a lot of people don't think it was... I was reading stuff that some people don't really think it's anything to write home about, but I have to kind of disagree. Like, I think that the story is so involving, and it's so smart, and it's very ambitious, which is what I give it the most credit for. This game is pretty ambitious as far as the narrative's concerned, and it's one of the more complex stories, especially for a video game. To do that, it's very rare. And especially to do it very well on such a high-budget scale, too, that, you know, a lot of money went into this game, and a lot of thought and a lot of time definitely went into this game. And you can definitely tell, because it's polished as hell. And it looks beautiful, it plays beautifully. And even though there's, like, you know, it's just, you know, for the most part, you know, it's a standard shooter for the most part for you know, for most of the gameplay, that didn't really bother me. Like, I wasn't, you know, like, bored or anything with it. Like, I was always fully entertained, never really had any problems with any of that, and, you know, like, even just the stuff that I'm going to talk about that, you know, I may disagree with or not have liked, it's mostly just nitpicking, because as far as I'm concerned, this is the best game I've played so far this year. It's the best game I've played since, outside of Portal 2, this is the best single-player experience I've had since, I don't even know, Red Dead Redemption, maybe. I might have enjoyed it more than that, so, I don't know, but I really enjoy it.
Right. So I guess a good place to go after this would probably be to talk about the gameplay a little bit, because I think that that's a much shorter conversation than
absolutely
getting down to the, you know, the game's aesthetic or the visual design elements of the game, which are incredible and I could talk for days about. So yeah.
Just the art direction alone, I think this game is worth the price you pay to own it. Is just to be able to kind of look around and experience Columbia.
Undoubtedly. I think that as far as the gameplay goes, I, like you said, I was really content with it. I don't think it's the standout element of the game.
Absolutely.
But you're so just adrift in how majestic and beautiful and well thought out everything around you is that you kind of fail to notice that it is a bit more of a run-of-the-mill shooter. And I think going into it, I was expecting the skyhook mechanics to be maybe a little bit, you know, to give it a hallmark gameplay feature, and it didn't really pan out for me.
Yeah, but the skyhook definitely doesn't, it's not like this isn't the factor they're trying to drive home. Like, this isn't the thing they're saying, hey, play this game because of this skyhook thing. It's just another element in the game that you get to do once in a while. You don't get to do it enough, in my opinion. If it was something that was kind of more constant through the game than it was, so that way you can kind of utilize it to your ability more and to the gameplay more, I think it would have been a little bit better. But the fact that it's so spread out throughout the game that it doesn't really affect the gameplay. That, I mean, it does, but, like, I use them all the time, and I thought they were really fun, and the first time you go on it, it's super exhilarating when you're riding it, and you freaking jump off and go, like, 40 feet and, like, kick one of the enemies in the head and then shoot somebody else. It's awesome, like, awesome moments like that, and it's easy to get away from, you know, it's good for, like, a, you know, if you get into a jam, you can, you know, just jump on the skyhook quick and, you know, go to the other side of the level, but...
Right. And I think the skyhook seems more innovative when you think of it in the context of other Bioshock games, because the previous two Bioshock games, and this is by no means a criticism, I think it's actually sort of where they shined, which is very claustrophobic environments, you know, underwater in Rapture.
Right.
And so the skyhook kind of differentiated itself from that and gave this Bioshock a whole new flavor.
Yeah,
but I think my major disappointment with the skyhook mechanics were that in the first gameplay trailer in 2010, they seemed to be a little bit more ambitious with implementing it. And another thing that I was slightly disappointed by, but this is just really the truth of the industry, is that that original gameplay trailer seemed much more open world.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, the battles seemed to unfold in many different ways. But I think that they had to narrow it and constrain it because it is sort of an end of life cycle game for this generation of consoles. And they probably had to make a couple of sacrifices in order to develop for those. So I'm not really going to hold that over its head. But
yeah.
another thing that I found interesting was that I really liked the Vigors, but once again, I sort of felt like it was a step down from the plasmids of Bioshock 1. And an illustration of this, I think, is the Bronco Vigor.
Yeah.
Is sort of like the telepathy plasmid in Bioshock 1. The telekinetic plasmid. But it didn't really have quite the same excitement to it. It didn't have the range of possibilities, because with the telekinetic plasmid, you could essentially pick up anything in the environment and use it as a projectile. Damage would scale, etc., etc. You could throw back grenades. The Bronco is really a lot more like a Mass Effect spell, where you essentially just hover enemies in the air and shoot them without them being able to retaliate.
Yeah.
So I found myself using fewer Vigors than I did plasmids in Bioshock 1, and I found them to be a little bit less elaborate, and they were less upgradable, and the game in general offered fewer upgrades than Bioshock 1. Once again, I think that Ken Levine and the design team was just really focusing on delivering to you an immersive experience where the shooting was just meant to give
it's
a crescendo
just
the
medium
in the action
for
of the
you to show
line.
You the narrative.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I think the Vigors are cool. Like, I like the idea of Vigors, because if there was no Vigors in this game, it wouldn't have nearly been as fun, because it would have just been a, like, every other shooter game that's out there, you know what I mean? But at least you can combo, and there's definitely some awesome moments, like when you know, use Bucking Bronco, and then you use the charge ability, or you throw Murder of Crows at somebody, and then you use Devil's Kiss to light them on fire. It's like, there's really cool combos and stuff like that that you can make really awesome stuff. Or using Undertow when you're up on, there's the one level where you're, you have to jump from, like, ship to ship when you're up in the air, and you're going towards, I forget whatever the name of the place is where Comstock is. And I'm using Undertow, and I'm just throwing enemies, like, into the abyss, like, into just off of these planes, or, like, off of these ships. Just cool stuff like that. But yeah, I agree, like, in Bioshock, I was, you know, I would run in, I would hit somebody, like, I would jump from a platform, like, from upstairs or something, throw an electricity bolt, like, the electricity plasmid at somebody, and then frickin' shoot them, like, then run towards them as they're electrocuted, and then just, like, pump one round of a shotgun into their head, and that'd be it. And that was it. In this game, it's like, you hit them with, you know, Devil's Kiss, and then you gotta proceed to shoot them, like, 10 times anyway. Like, the plasmids weren't, I mean, the Vigors weren't super powerful. Like, you couldn't just get by just using the Vigors. And while the same is true for Bioshock, it's less true, because you can still, like, I'd be able to do, like, a lot less, I would have to use a lot less ammo to kill an enemy that's already been hit by a plasmid than I did by hitting somebody with a Vigor in Infinite, if that makes any sense.
It's really interesting, actually. In comparing the games, I think that Ken Levine actually intended to make a point with some of this. In Bioshock 1, I guess here's where the spoiler disclaimer comes in, but it's pretty much an underwater city that's ravaged by people that have gone insane from abusing these DNA modification materials, plasmids.
Right.
And everything seems really scarce in that game. I remember times where I'm just praying and praying and praying for a clip for my pistol.
Yeah.
And I think that scarcity was really interesting. Whereas in Bioshock Infinite, we're sort of presented in Colombia with a capitalist paradise. I mean, we have Fink and his massive factories that are producing weaponry and pretty much everything that, this floating city needs.
Yeah.
And you know, also I think this has to do with Elizabeth scavenging for ammo for you, but there's never scarcity in this game. And I think that it goes along, the change in the gameplay also is consistent with the change in the world. Whereas instead of, you know, even though we see a city that's floating tenuously in the sky, it's full of abundance and it's like this hyper-capitalistic society. So I thought that was really cool. My complaint with the plasmids isn't really about functionality. I thought some of them were really cool. I probably, when I was playing through it, didn't really use as many of the plasmids in diverse situations as I should have, which is my fault. I really just bought the upgrade for Murder of Crows, and it was so powerful that I use that almost constantly.
Yeah, there was a couple of vigors that I just did not use really ever.
Right.
Like, I would have them be like, oh yeah, I forgot I have this vigor, like the Shock Jockey, which I guess if you upgrade it enough would be really cool, because it can jump, like with the most upgraded thing, you can, it hits like a bunch of enemies. But I never used it, like I was always just like, oh yeah, I forgot, Shock Jockey, I forgot I had that, maybe I'll try that out for this fight or something. But I always kept like the same four plasmids on me, like I would use the same four vigors for the majority of the game.
Yeah, I think that if two of us have done that, and I was really trying to get the most out of this experience, but if both of us found ourselves using the same vigors over and over again, maybe they could have designed it so that you were forced to use different vigors in different situations a little bit more.
Right. And the thing is, what's really funny is that in Bioshock Infinite, there's, you know, you go into Columbia and you find all these stands and you see these advertisements for all these vigors, for like Devil's Kiss and Murder of Crows and everything, but no one else uses them in this game. You're the only person who's like super powered now, uses these like magic vigors that give you like these superpowers that seem to be readily available to anyone since they're advertising it, and they just have stands where they give out free samples, but yet no one else in this game uses them. Whereas in Bioshock, there were guys, you know, that would, I mean, they didn't really use plasmids either, but I felt like that wasn't really part of the kind of the story. Like, this is like, they're shoving it in your face. They're like, this is just like, it's like eating a, it's like promoting like a food. Like, anyone could just go up and like get it. But yet no one in the game uses them.
Yeah, I thought that was sort of a strange point. Maybe it would just be that battles would be too difficult and chaotic if people were using the exact same plasmids as you were. But it is a sort of an interesting little quirk in the story.
Yeah.
That in essence, in a world where vigors exist, there would be no such thing as a civilian, right? Because they would all be able to throw these firebombs, the Devil's Kiss, at you. And
right.
But yet you continuously run into civilians. So as far as the gameplay goes, I think that it's pretty easy to say that the gameplay is solid enough to not impede on the story and not disappoint.
It keeps you entertained. Absolutely. Right.
So I think the next question is, do you think that the visuals and the story of this game in combination with the huge success have set the bar ridiculously high for games going forward? Do you think that this game changed the industry?
No, definitely not. I don't think it changed. If anything, it just makes it more promising that there might be other games that will come out that introduce a really in-depth and creative story. Almost like to the point where it's like, you know, you're watching Inception almost, you know what I mean? Like, it's just this complex story. I mean, it's not even necessary that it has to be complex. It's just that it's kind of a new idea. Like, it's something that hasn't really been done in a game as far as I know. And, the only other thing I can really think of that's kind of done a narrative this well, that's been this, interesting, and I felt like I was always on board and I couldn't wait to see what happened in the story, is Half-Life. Half-Life 2 and that series, which still isn't even completed yet. But I feel like that's the only other game where I felt like I was part of this world and you're just going through this narrative as the person who's kind of a major, you know, plot point in the game. But you're experiencing it as him. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't think it does. I don't think it really. It's not. I don't think it's really going to set any bars. I mean, I will definitely be finding it. I will definitely be comparing games in the future to this as far as like narrative's concerned. But as far as you know, gameplay, obviously, I don't think it's anything really new. It's interesting, you know, and you know, it plays the same as Bioshock for the most part. Like the first Bioshock, it's, you know, you use plasmids, you use these magic powers. And you have weapons. You have an array of different weapons that you can also upgrade. So
I think that something that the industry is going to eventually have to come around to is that they need to think more cinematically. And I can give many examples in this game of just incredible visual crescendos, like, and they happen early too. For instance, I'm always, and I've played through this part of the game 3 or 4 times now, I'm always astounded at the part right after the raffle where you go into this hall and there's a, and there's a, essentially the Columbia's version of the KKK. It's right before you fight the first boss that gives you Murder of Crows. And the scenery just becomes more pronouncedly gloomy. You see all this rotten food, and it's this incredible buildup to what's essentially the first boss, even though he falls pretty easy, so you don't quite notice. And I think that I found that other games have kind of been doing a similar thing where each level continues the same aesthetic, but yet has the hallmarks and sort of like almost visual foreshadowing of what's coming next. And it's a very cinematic technique, and I think that studios would probably do well to hire creative directors and art designers that can do this kind of stuff, because it really gets your palms sweaty. It gets you wondering what's going to happen next. And I mean, when another game that did this pretty well was actually the new Devil May Cry game, DMC. And I hope that the industry really clings to this, because it's a great way of rebuffing that old claim by Ebert and others that video games aren't really art, that they're essentially just there to kind of pass time or test your reflexes. Yeah. And I think that it really brings a new level of artistry to games. And this is just coming out. And I also agree that Half-Life did this pretty well. But it's more about coordinating the visuals with the storyline for me. That's just great. And it really draws you that much more into the game.
Definitely.
So let's see.
I just want to talk about the, let's get into like the story, of the game, I guess the real thing that needs to be, I guess, discussed here. I think we all kind of understand what happens towards the end of the game. They do kind of leave a semi, I'm trying to think the way that the very end of the game happens, when it's the post credits thing, there's that little thing at the post credits where Booker, obviously these are all spoilers again, where Booker is like, he wakes up at his apartment and he is like pushing the door to see if Anne is there, and then it like cuts like Inception style before you see if anything happens. But I feel like I feel like obviously she has to kind of be there, because everything, like the way that the story goes, it all points to that like she would be there.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a lot that's interesting to talk about with that little snippet at the end after the credits. One of them is this the Booker that you've been playing as the entire game, right?
Right.
And I think that that's what one incredible part of this game is, that it deploys the first person shooter convention of not seeing yourself. Because if you were to see yourself in the end, the spoiler that your Comstock would sort of be given away, right? Because as you're walking through these doors, you would eventually look more and more like Comstock in some of them. But I think that, right. So one of the questions is this the Booker DeWitt that we've been playing as all along?
I think it has to be, because when Elizabeth drowns Booker during the baptism, and all of the Elizabeths, you know, start disappearing when they drown him, at that point, that's the choice. That's like the one of the infinite, you know, different things that happen or that could happen. That's the choice of when he chose to be baptized, and that starts off a whole wing of just Comstock realities. Whereas if he doesn't take the baptism, so basically he gets to the water. And there's two, it strays off into two paths, obviously. One where he refuses the baptism, and one where he accepts the baptism. And the one where he accepts the baptism then strands out into, you know, a bunch of different things that are all Comstock, where he becomes Comstock after the baptism. So if he's not baptized, you know, so him accepting the baptism but getting drowned, it, you know, erases any possibility of Comstock and Elizabeths that would have ever existed, which is actually, you know, kind of sad if you think about it, because, you know, you've been playing the way that the game ends, there's no Elizabeth. Like, the girl that you've played through this entire game with, that you've spent, you know, 10 plus hours with, that you've come to know and, like, kind of, you know have kind of like a relationship with, mm-hmm. is like dead, more or less. Is that because she never becomes Elizabeth, because Comstock never has to go back through the tears and take Anna to become Elizabeth.
Right.
So Elizabeth will never exist then. So it's basically just Anna. So that other Booker, the one that refuses the baptism, is what I have come to believe when he opens the door to find Elizabeth there. I mean, to find Anna, excuse me.
Right. So I hope that everybody has played through the ending and paid close attention to it. Right. So leading up to the ultimate scene where he's drowned, you have to remember there is that one Booker that Anna created where he refused the baptism.
Right.
And so I think that that is the one. And then you move on from there, and all of the Comstocks are essentially destroyed.
Right. Created, I guess.
Never created. But, you know, and there are questions. It's not really so. I think it's very constructive if you don't think of it necessarily as like infinite universes, but just the ones that we
pass through first person. Right. Yeah, right.
One thing that I really thought was kind of, I don't know if it was a loose end or what, but there are still the Lutices that are out there, right? And every universe that they pass through, you have to consider as at least tangential to the storyline as well.
Right, but I think that the point of the Lutesses are that they basically helped Comstock take Anna, but then, you know, they realized that this isn't, you know, that's like what's happening. So they, you know, that's, you know, when they go back to get Booker in the first place to, you know, stop all of this from happening, basically. So they are, you know, as far as you know, on Booker's side, although you can tell that, like, what's really interesting is that, you know, they're like the most interesting characters in this game as far as I'm concerned. And I love the way they kind of go about, like, how they kind of present themselves and how they handle themselves. Cause like they're not like, you know, being very straightforward about everything. And you can tell that, like, they've seen this Booker come through and make these decisions time and time and time again in these different instances, because you see the one thing when you first go in and you flip the coin and they're all heads. Obviously you've seen, like, they've seen Booker come through and do this time and time again.
Right. And selecting the medallion for Elizabeth's necklace once again.
Which one did you choose, by the way?
Oh, so I chose the bird.
Yeah. So I think everyone chose the bird. I thought the cage
was a little gloomy and sort of bad foreshadowing.
I'm not sure what implication that would have changed if you had chosen the cage.
I heard it changes really minute things. You could actually find a list of it on certain websites. Yes, I haven't really looked it up,
but I don't know anyone who's like, next time I go through, I'm definitely going to choose the cage just to see, but I haven't, you know, I don't know how directly that would change things. But.
Yeah, so it doesn't change anything on a grand scale, but supposedly it changes, like, dialogues, even just, like, small words, and it changes the ending dialogue slightly. It changes which Elizabeth says Comstock and which Elizabeth says Booker DeWitt, which is interesting. And I think that there's probably some underlying meaningful symbolism there. Because obviously the bird in the cage, there's that famous illusion where you wind up, you know, the sides of a paper, one is the cage and one is the bird, and you wind it up and you spin it and they remain separate, but it looks like the bird's in the cage. I think it's definitely an allusion to that little device.
Right.
I think one incredible thing about this game is that it just calls into question fate and choice so much.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the reasons the Lutesses are so interesting is because we think that the decisions that we make when we encounter them matter so much, when in fact they don't really at all. It's more for them to figure out who we are than for us to determine who Booker DeWitt is going to be going forward. And I thought that that was an incredible little meta commentary on video games and character customization and everything. But another really interesting part of the game is how Kevin Levine and the writing staff kind of chose to undermine how much information we can get from the voxophones. And in particular, I'm sort of referencing the voxophones that you encounter in the asylum if you would call it that, where they deter Elizabeth and ultimately make her into a weapon of mass destruction. We encounter Voxaphones where she's praying for Booker to save her, and then other Voxaphones of the same voice where she's lost, and then other Voxaphones where it seems like she's been brainwashed.
Right.
And I thought that that was like a great moment of time conflation, but it was also one of the most confusing moments. And it's sort of, I still haven't panned out all of the implications of those Voxaphones, but
yeah, there's so many, there's 80 in the game and I never found all of them yet, but that's, if you really want to understand the story, that's the one thing to pay attention to, is to listen to every Voxaphone and pay attention to it. Cause they give the meat of the story, basically all of the backstory and explanations of everything that's going on, especially like, as far as like, you know, the metaphysics of the world and these terrors and realities, you know, the Lutessa is explaining these quantum physics, you know, physical, you know, changes and devices that they're creating, really allow you to understand a lot more about the game.
Right. So, man, we could just, I think I could probably talk for hours about even just every little, every pane of the story that you see at the end.
Yeah, they really hit you with a lot of resolution in the last 25 minutes of this game. They just lay it on.
So, I guess we could, this, and this is just going to be speculation, but since we've played both games, what did you think of the Bioshock 1 tie-in when you go down to the bathysphere and the songbird actually dies at the bottom of the sea there? Yeah,
that was awesome.
it was definitely really cool. I thought it was really fascinating, the design parallels between the Big Daddy and the Songbird.
Yes, I was just actually going to say that. Yeah, there's always, like, I love the things throughout, like, these themes throughout the game that they explain. Like, I think it's Elizabeth who says, like, there's always a man, there's always, a machine, there's always a woman, and there's always, like, a force, like an authority that, you know, holds you down, that, you know, you rebel against, whatever. And it's like the same themes that go on in Bioshock that go into Bioshock Infinite. And I love those little references. But yeah, like, the Songbird and Big Daddies have, like, even as far as like the construction's concerned, like the eyes, when they turn, you know, when they're yellow, they're like, they're okay. And then like they turn red and like, they're going like batshit crazy. They're gonna like attack you and kill you. But yeah, like, yeah, definitely, there's definitely tie-ins there. And, but as far as the, when you first ended up in Rapture, I was thinking to myself was, oh, please don't let this be, like, the result of everything. Do you know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
Like, I was like, please don't let this be, like, what happens after Columbia falls. Like, it falls to the bottom of the sea and, like, that's Rapture or something silly like that. And I was really hoping that wasn't going to be the case. And it wasn't. Obviously, it was just that Rapture is just one of the infinite possibilities that these lighthouses lead to, basically. So,
yeah.
If you think of it as, like you were saying, each of these lighthouses all represent a different choice of everything, obviously, but a different part of the Bioshock universes. So, like, think of it as, like, each lighthouse is, like, a different Bioshock, almost.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And, I think, let me see. I think some of the things that struck me as strange for, oh man, this is, I just realized how tough this game is to talk about.
It really
is. It's one of those
games. There's so much, dude. It's so dense. Yeah.
And it's one of those games that's easier to diagram almost than talk about.
And this is also why I think it's a good game too, is because you can talk about it for so long. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's some games I could talk about, like, where I played them and, you know, I may have really enjoyed playing through them, but then afterwards, like, you know, a couple months down the road or something, like, I'll totally forget that I played them, or that, you know, I'll talk about them and like the conversation will not last more than, you know, 5-10 minutes. Whereas this game, since I've played it, all I've done is like read stuff about it, watch videos about it, think about it and talk to people about it, and then play through the original Bioshock, and, you know, now I want to go back through and play through Infinite again.
Exactly. I guess I'll just have some sort of random theories that I came up with. I haven't checked to see if anybody else has thought about them, but, I guess you could almost consider them Easter eggs, just like little, they might be consequences of quantum travel, or they might just be stylistic decisions, but one of the things I was thinking of is a lot of the songs in the game are songs from our reality.
Right.
Right. And I was sort of wondering, you know, given that Comstock is this prophet and this religious leader, it's quite possible that he wrote some kind of hymnal for his religion and found those songs in our reality. So we have the Beach Boys covered by the Barbershop Quartet, right?
Right.
And that's an anachronism because that song was obviously released in the 60s.
Right.
But is it possible that Comstock, through one of the tears or one of the test fields, heard that song in our dimension and sort of appropriated it to his cause because he thought it fit?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And there's really no way to know
that. But it's so interesting. You know, this game just opens up all these possibilities with tie-ins. And then
Love the music. The music, the musical choices in this game are like awesome. Like the little things here and there are fantastic. So
definitely. Sorry. And the score was but yeah, it's so cool. I mean, I was also really enticed and I sort of wish that they, did this a little bit more, but with, Elizabeth Anna/Anna opening up the holes to other universes that just were entirely aesthetically different. Like when we see her open up that hole to the tear to Paris, and there's an ambulance careening toward us, and there's a marquee with a French cinema. And then again in the elevator, when there's kind of what seems like just a country ranch home, and we see the songbird flying in that tear. I hope that the DLC has more of those moments because they're just weird and uncanny and totally awesome.
I'm really excited to see what the DLC is going to bring because I really don't know how they're going to do this unless they do. I feel like if they do anything post end of this game, it's not going to be very fun because there's not going to be any Columbia.
Right.
And if they do anything like anything with Booker, basically, if you play as Booker again and anything that's like post game or pre game is not really going to be as fun. I feel. Do you know what I mean? Because you've already experienced everything that there is to experience in the game, in the narrative, and it's such a tightly wound narrative that there's really no room for expansion.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's going to be a contortionist feat to actually produce good DLC from this, and I do not hold it beyond the developers of BioShock Infinite to do this, but I just, as a layperson, I can't see where it's going to fit in. I was thinking that maybe you would kind of get the backstory of the martyr Booker who died, you know, for the Vox Populi.
Right. But, yeah, I was thinking that too, but...
But the gameplay wouldn't be all that different from
BioShock gameplay. You would know the outcome already.
Right, so...
Well, I mean, unless you're in a tear that we haven't experienced, almost, like a different reality.
You know, I think it might move across the realities rather than like vertically down a timeline.
Right.
But they're still going to have to do quite a bit and throw a couple extra spices into the mix, I think, to make it a satisfying and differentiated DLC.
Yeah. So I mean, we'll see. I'm really excited. I have it purchased already. So as soon as it comes out, I'll be playing it.
Yep. Me too.
But, what was I going to say? There's something I just want to talk about real quick.
Well, actually I have something if you,
okay, go ahead. Yeah. Sorry.
You want me to pitch on that? Well, a couple of people, and I think that they're really misguided and don't understand satire, but they've kind of complained about the depictions of race and religion in this.
Yeah, so I don't understand those arguments.
I don't really either. I guess if you're religious, I could see maybe why you would be hesitant to fully embrace this game's idea of religion. But, you know, those arguments to me seem really silly, although in good satire and in good political commentary, you always get people that are offended.
Yeah. I mean, it's 1912 America. Like, what did you expect?
Exactly.
That's how it was back then. Like, I mean, it's a kind of an exaggerated extreme case of it, but that's kind of the point, almost. Do you know what I mean? Like, so I don't understand why people are getting all up in arms. Like, it's not like they're purposely trying to, you know, make races like look bad or something, like to insult people by any means.
So. Right. I sort of think that in a certain way, it's way more sensitive to race issues than most video games ever would be.
Especially most movies. Jesus.
Right. Because, you know, even though it depicts subjugated, subjugated racial class of workers, like all of the black people that you encounter, with the exception of those that are in the Vox Populi, are like sweeping floors and being very demure. But you, if anything, to me, it made me understand that predicament more than I did in the past, because you walk through these absolutely ramshackle washrooms that they have to use, and you there's one point when you're going toward the amusement park where it says, like, mind you, there's a big banner when you're where all the workers change, and it says, mind your manners around your betters. And I didn't think that it was endorsing that at all. It was actually making you experience that kind of monstrosity firsthand, because we live in an era where that's all been legislated away.
Right.
And I'd almost rather like to see more video games tackle that in a sensitive way, because it's so immersive and it really brings a new reality to it. But I think that it will always discomfort people that a video game tries to present that reality that's now gone away. As far as the religion goes, I think it's obviously a bit anti-religion in general, but Comstock was, he's so far from paralleling any sort of religious figure that has existed or will exist, because he has quantum powers.
So, yeah.
That I think that it's not necessarily against all religion. I think it's just against the type of religion that excludes some people and has sort of a racial basis and a nationalistic basis. So I thought if anything, that was the strength of the game, was that it decided to take on those topics.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And it doesn't like hold back by any means, which is great, because it would fall short if trying to like to not offend someone or not to offend a certain group of people or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to talk about real quick, to finish up here, because we could talk about this for like another hour, but I wanted to talk about how you felt about the game compared to the original BioShock.
Okay.
Well, like as far like just in terms of enjoyment, like in that kind of thing.
Right. I found that they, even though the gameplay mechanics and the scope of their ambition were really similar, I found myself feeling really differently when I played Infinite from when I played the first BioShock, and that was really excellent, and that's a difficult feat to do. So when I was playing this BioShock, oftentimes I found myself just in awe, like when you're standing when you're looking at the cloudscape, or when you're standing in front of a stained glass window depicting some incident in Comstock's life. I was just totally astounded and taken aback by that, almost as if I were, you know, visiting a cathedral in another country.
Right.
And in BioShock 1, I thought it was very much, it had more of a survival horror feel. Like I was saying, the scarcity of ammo.
Yeah.
You hear these sort of unhinged people rambling to themselves around the corner. You see their shadows and then they scamper away. And it had much more of like a claustrophobic kind of like Ridley Scott Alien feel to it.
Yeah, definitely.
And I like both of them in different ways. I'm a really big fan of survival horror, so I think that as far as the gameplay goes, I sort of connected more with BioShock 1, but the story, they just outdo themselves with the story and with the presentation of this game. So I like both of them equally, but Infinite really stuck with me because of how far it set itself away from the pack, just with the visuals, the sound, the immersiveness of the experience. So how do you think they compare?
Yeah, I played through Infinite, and then I went right through and played through the first BioShock. And the only thing I was able to really think about while playing through the original BioShock was, I can't wait to go back and play through BioShock Infinite again. Like, that's what I felt through a lot of the game. Maybe it was because I've played through the original BioShock before. Granted, it was a long time ago. So it felt like there was a lot of stuff I forgot, or, you know, that, like, I may have missed the last time through, because I was very thorough the second playthrough on the first BioShock. And the gameplay, like, I know it's only, what, like, 5 years old now?
2007? Yeah, I think it came out in 2007.
Yeah. So it's, like, 5 or 6 years, give or take. It feels kind of dated. Certain aspects of the game feel kind of dated. Especially some of the, combat mechanics, like, it's kind of hard to explain. Like, I feel like sometimes, I would hit somebody, if somebody was too close, to me, like a body or something, and I would go to shoot them, like I'd have my cursor on them, but they were like too close to me, so like I would like shoot through them almost. Like just like graphical like little things here and there that obviously because of, you know, it's, you know, how old it is and compared to like how much technology has evolved since then. Obviously you look at BioShock Infinite, and I'm sure we'll look at BioShock Infinite 6 years from now when another game comes out and we're like, oh man, like what this game, you know, this is nothing compared to what's out now. But yeah, like I agree with what you said about like the survival horror aspect of the first BioShock. There's definitely that more sense of like fear and anxiety in the first BioShock. But yeah, I think I need to let Infinite like settle for like a long period of time. Like I need to, like, if I were to say which game do I prefer, or like which game would I if I had to pick a game to play right now, which one would I play? If I would ask myself that, you know, 6 months from now or a year from now, it might be different than, you know, asking me right at this second. Just in terms of, you know, which game I enjoyed playing more, like which one I had more fun going through, I would say probably Infinite. Just maybe because the story was more immersive and I felt like I enjoyed it more. Like the story in 1 is fantastic and I love it. And it was, you know, something that wasn't a very normal thing to come out during that time when it came out. Which is why it was so innovative, and the use of plasmids, and that was all kind of new. But since that's already done, I feel like even though this game, you know, borrows the majority of it from that, I still feel like I enjoyed a lot from this game more. But I enjoyed the hell out of both of them, and I can't wait for the DLC for this game, and any future BioShock... Well... Any future Ken Levine games. I'm not sure even if he can produce another BioShock game, because how do you... This is, like, the wrap-up.
Yeah.
Like, Infinite is, like, the tie on the present. Like, the icing on the cake, whatever.
Definitely. I hope that whatever Ken Levine goes on to do, he kind of sticks with his ethos of taking on big topics. You know, there's a lot of great indie games that focus on one concept, but I'm just really... a fan of Ken Levine's ambition, and so I hope whatever he goes on to do, it's on a huge scale like this.
And
game
I really
was.
Hope, like, as far as I love the way that his gameplay works and gameplay mechanics, where, you know, of the powers plus shooter, I really hope that he can maybe try and innovate gameplay in some sort of different way, like in a different manner. Because, you know, I'm trying to think of a way that Infinite, the gameplay mechanics in Infinite, would have made it stand out even more. And I don't know how that would happen. I'm trying to think of... Because there's no way you can really... Like, what the easiest way for a game designer to bring a player through a narrative experience easily and productively and commercially would be to make it a shooter, basically. And there's
aside from adventure games, maybe. Yeah. But that's not a commercially popular genre.
Right, yeah. Like, if it had just been like... I'm trying to figure out a game to like compare it to. I guess like Resident Evil 4, maybe. So it's like, I mean, that's still kind of a shooter, but like there's still like if they made it so like it's cutscenes and then like you have like these, like, you know, they're not cutscenes, you still have to like do actions, like you have to hit a button or a combination or something to like get through events. It. Which is sometimes kind of gimmicky to me. I mean, I will say I think God of War 3 does that the best of any game.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think of a way that Infinite could have been done differently as far as gameplay mechanics, and I can't really think of one off the top of my head.
Yeah, I can't really either. The only way that I ever really think of improving the mechanics is making it more like the gameplay demo that was shown at E3. And that's
which
sort
is
of
still
silly.
A shooter.
Right. It's still a shooter. The thing, and we'll never play that demo, so we'll never know. But I was actually thinking, looking at that demo, I was thinking that that the Songbird would show up a lot more, and that there would be like really dynamic events with the Songbird instead of them being kind of scripted set pieces. That's pretty much the only thing that I would have liked more of, was sort of the feeling of constantly being pursued.
Yeah.
And
the Songbird
that came across
was
well,
kind of, was probably the most underwritten part of the game, I would think. Mm-hmm. Well, with the exception of one other thing I'm going to add in as soon as you're done. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sure. Actually, I'm all done, but I'm really curious to see what you thought was underwritten, because I have maybe, like, one or two things that I would have liked to see fleshed out a little more, too.
Yeah. Any information on Booker's past that caused all of this to happen in the first place is never explained, really. He has a gambling debt, and that's pretty much the extent of what you know about it.
Right. That's pretty frustrating.
It is, but I guess the reason why they didn't do it, because I guess there's really no way to... There's really no way to, like, argue and elicit a correct way, like a humane way to say this is worth giving up my child for. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing they can have really came up with that people wouldn't have been like, really? I mean, even in general, like, giving up your child, like, I mean, who does that? So it's like, what could have possibly been wrong? One thing I did, actually, I heard this really interesting theory, which I feel like makes it a little bit more believable and better, is that when they say gambling debts, if you think of it in terms of not like financial gambling debts, but more of like we will erase the debt, give us the girl, we will erase the debt, like talking about like morally, like the things that he's done. Yeah, like his guilt, like the things he's done in Wounded Knee and in his past. Like, you know, these Lutece twins that come through a tear from the future. You know, he might think of them as like some sort of supernatural being or god that can, you know, have the power to, you know, get him into heaven per se or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, so he erased the debt, like more of like a, you know, not as on the nose about that, like, you know, morally kind of, which I thought was really interesting. And if anything, makes it a little bit more believable, I guess, to give up your kid in order to do that. I don't know.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting. One thing that I hope that they could explore in the DLC, and they did an okay job of this in the Voxaphones, but I was pretty fascinated with Fink, but I felt like he didn't quite exist and didn't quite come to life in the same way that, for instance, Comstock or the Lutesses did.
Right.
And so I felt that too. I'm hoping that in some way they're able to kind of give his role in the whole universe a little bit more meat and sustenance. But yeah, other than that, I just was amazed with, and
the he fact reminded is, me a lot of kind of like Sander Cohen from the original BioShock.
Yeah, definitely.
Even though you do, and like even though, you know, Cohen eventually does come down and you do meet him face to face, granted it's a very small, short like face to face, like it's a hey, congratulations, you did this, and then you have the ability to, you have the option to kill him or to not kill him,
right?
But as far as Fink's concerned, like, you don't ever really get to him. He gets murdered before you get there,
he kind of, his demise is very off screen and very out of your hands, so that's interesting. And I guess it's a little bit more, it's beyond the scope of the game to kind of tackle the big sort of monopolistic enterprise that he runs. I think that the game focuses a lot more on religion and choice, but he's a big fueler of the disparity. And I really liked that, coming from a background in economics, I wanted more, like I wanted to know how his enterprise was sustained and stuff.
It's really interesting. And I was really expecting a little bit more out of that part of him in the game. You know what I mean? Like, I was expecting some sort of intense boss fight where he has like this ridiculous, like robot with a bunch of machine guns or something, like a Patriot on crack or something.
Yeah, that would have been nice, but there's always hope for the DLC.
Yeah. All right, well, I think that about wraps it up. We've been talking for almost an hour, but I'd like to possibly revisit this once some of the DLC comes out. Definitely not after the first one, but maybe after, like, some of it. I don't even know if there's going to be more than one. I don't know. But anyway, I'm assuming there will be. Mm-hmm. You know, when that stuff comes out, maybe we'll revisit this and we'll talk about that in the future. So thanks for joining me, Mark.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Rambling About Notable Topics. You can find all of our episodes, plus the rant blog, at ajazznetworks.com, as well as our other great content, including Ajazz Tech, The Salinor Show, and Internet Amazings. You can follow the official rant Twitter at Rambling Topics, and myself at Kyle Cicilloni. You can also listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher Radio.
You can find this show and more at Ajazz Networks. originally different media for your personal taste.